supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of them jam-packed shows for you, cats and kittens. Little bit later on, we will be interviewing a poison ivy expert who has some great things to tell us about that rashy plant. We're also going to talk about the Three Sisters, the Native American way of growing corn, beans, and squash in unison and together with each other. That's a lot to get done, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well, Chris. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks very much.
And where is Chris Great?
I am just north of Philadelphia in a little town called Lansdale.
I know Lansdale. You don't sound like a native Lansdalian, Chris.
No, originally from a little further south than that, from New Zealand.
Oh, okay. That I guess that you can get there in any direction.
That's true.
Take you about the same. Okay. What can we do for Chris in Lansdale?
Well, I'm calling about what I think is some zoysia grass. We bought our house from the original owners around 6 years ago, and I was mowing the lawn during that first summer, and I noticed that the strip of grass between the sidewalk and the street was a little different than the rest of the grass around the place. So it was kind of like a thick carpet and didn't really need as much mowing as the rest of the lawn, and it didn't really brown off like the rest of the lawn during the sort of drought periods. And really didn't think much more about it until the winter. And all of a sudden, it looked like it was dying. It became nasty brown and dead-looking, and the rest of the lawn was, you know, a nice Lansdale green, as you'd expect. So I was somewhat relieved that in the springtime, it came back, that nice green sort of lush carpet returned. So I had some concerns about this grass. Number one, my neighbors didn't like it. And number two, it sort of seemed to be spreading. So it started out on that little strip, sort of, between the sidewalk and the road, but it looked like it had started growing into our sort of main lawn, as if the sort of the roots had gone underneath the footpath or something.
How wide is the footpath?
Probably about 3 feet, I would imagine.
It would be a stretch, but it would not be unheard of. Is it a regular city sidewalk, or is it pieces you could lift up?
It looks like it's individual sort of slabs. So
be
I don't think I'd be confident lifting it up for a look, though.
Be interesting to see if one is loose or anything like that, if you lifted it under to see if there's like a little great escape going on under there.
Yeah.
Well, you have an interesting situation. You have like a display of the two different types of grasses. Your main lawn is a cool season grass. As you noted, it suffers greatly during the heat of summer, but it loves cold weather.
Right.
The zoysia grass, which is very popular, is a warm season grass that, you know, you're making it sound more ugly than it needs to be, Chris, over the winter. It goes tan and dormant. But as you know, as you saw, it thrives in the heat of the summer.
Loves it.
It's very low care. And I suspect you've never seen a weed in this little bit of zoysia grass.
Weeds got no chance.
Yes, whereby weeds are always trying to get into your, quote, summer lawn because it's weakened by the heat.
Correct, yep.
So it is very difficult to find grasses that thrive in these little strip plantings in between the sidewalk and the street.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest to you that you leave the zoysia grass there. If you take it out, you're probably going to have to put in some sort of sedum ground cover, or you might wind up paving the area over, and we don't need more impervious surfaces. But I don't think a cool season grass is going to survive down there. With your regular grass, for your regular grass to survive summer a little bit better, perhaps, you don't want to sow any seed until the fall. You want always to have it cut at 3 inches. You never want to cut below 3 inches. Feed it gently in the spring. Give it a big feeding in the fall. Don't dare feed your main lawn in the summertime. That helps burn it out.
Okay.
And when you water, water deeply and infrequently.
All right.
Now, the zoysia grass, if you really want to remove it, you would remove it in the fall as it's going dormant. That's when it can't protect itself. But I'm telling you, nothing is going to do as well there. And instead, I would suggest you go out and buy really deep edging and pound it down into the ground around the zoysia grass. And then any zoysia grass that has crept into the lawn that you want, you remove that in September. That's in middle of August. You can just plow up that part of your lawn, dig out any zoysia grass you can find, lay down some more dirt, put in fresh matching seed. That seed will grow up, and because it's getting cool out, that seed will overwhelm the zoysia.
Well, sounds like great advice, and I appreciate it.
All right, man.
Love the show. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Good luck.
Goodbye.
1-888-346-9499. Melissa, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi there.
Hello.
My name is Melissa. I'm calling from Newark, Delaware.
What can we do for Melissa in Newark?
So I was doing some gardening in the fall, and I have this really nice hydrangea bush that always has these really pretty blue flowers. And my neighbor, right next door, I live in a duplex, hers are always pink. And so I was trying to put some edging in, so I'm digging down a little bit deeper, and I found a large piece of something that was really rusty, and I took it out. It was unrecognizable, so I'm not quite sure what it was, but I threw it away, and then I was thinking perhaps my hydrangea are blue because this piece of rust was there, so I'm a little bit of a scientist and interested in the experiment to see what happens in the spring. Will they grow pink instead of blue?
Well, it's interesting because now you kind of introduced something new into the equation. When you talk about these basic type of hydrangeas, the ones that typically have quote-unquote pink flowers, you can make the flowers blue by acidifying the soil. And conversely, you can make the pink flowers stay pink by spreading a little bit of wood ash or lime to affect their pH. But I'm presuming that this bit of garden debris that you dug up is an old gardening tool of some kind?
It may be an old piece of, like a little shovel or something like that. It was about 6 inches wide, but I just didn't want that rusty bit in my garden. I moved in about 5 years ago, so I hadn't dug down that deep. I was putting in this, like an edging for the garden to separate it from the lawn. So I was just wondering if that might have an effect on the soil if it takes some of the acidity out of the soil.
Oh, you mean when you remove the iron, is that going to remove
exactly
the acidity? Crazy people who don't follow the organic method who want to turn their hydrangeas blue will spread aluminum sulfate. And perhaps the metallic elements here do have an effect either of acidifying the soil, or maybe there's a different effect that also turns these flowers blue. They really like it. This is the only plant I know of where the flower color can be manipulated like this. But I'll tell you something I found that has astounded me as a gardener. If your hydrangeas open up pink in the late spring, you have plenty of time to turn them blue even after they're open. You can mess with them.
Yeah. That's what I thought was kind of interesting. I like to do some experimentation, and so I wanted to see if it really affected the flower at all, not having this piece of rust in the garden.
You could spread some rust around, or you could get a little bit of the chelated iron that's sold for greening up lawns. Iron is used horticulturally, very specifically, and I'm guessing your old piece of equipment was made of iron. So you can play around with that. But I'll tell you the trick that I do is I spread a lot of peat moss at the back of my hydrangeas and some wood ash from my wood stove in front. And then I get pink and blue flowers on the same plant.
So should I just wait and see what happens here? I'm not interested in, per se, turning it back to blue, So I'm more interested in seeing what happens with this as a result of removing that rust from the ground.
Whatever that element was,
yeah.
Probably iron, there's probably enough of it in the ground for that plant to absorb for the next, like, 4 or 5 years.
Oh, okay.
These elemental things, you know, phosphorus, potassium, iron, copper, these plant nutrients tend to persist in the soil and to be taken up very slowly by plants. So I think if you're going to see any dramatic change, it's going to be when the plant has used up the iron or it's all kind of washed away.
Okay.
But it'd be fun. And like I said, if you want them blue, some peat moss. If you want them pink, some wood ash.
I might try the wood ash just to see what happens, since you said it may still continue to be blue, and see if I can get a little speckled plant.
You could even have a striped plant if you wanted to play around.
Oh, wow. Well, that's fun. Thanks so much for your advice. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's a great call.
Great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind lawn owners who want to get their grass off drugs that the time is fast approaching to apply corn gluten meal as your springtime feeding and chemical-free pre-emergent. But to be weed-preventingly effective, corn gluten must be applied to your turf just as the local red buds and forsythia begin to bloom. That means you need to have it in hand before that. Ahem. But don't go searching for your CGM just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, a fascinating discussion about poison ivy, and how to grow the three sisters in the true Native American way. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, how to grow the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash in true Native American style. And of course, lots more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it's time for our special guest, poison ivy expert Umar Micah, who is going to be holding his first ever Poison Ivy Conference in West Fairmount Park here in Philadelphia, March 25th to the 28th. Umar, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
Now, Umar, your day job is as a groundskeeper for the Philadelphia Zoo, and you have been there forever, right? You told me, is it 40 years you've been a groundskeeper at the zoo?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And is that where your fascination with the poison ivy plant began, or was this just part of living in a world with poison ivy?
Well, actually, my fascination with it began much earlier when I was a scout and we started to learn about poisonous plants. And I realized that the pictures in the manual and what was out there on the ground were two different things. That started me on a quest to learn what is it actually.
Right. Now, the oil that all these plants have in common, we call them poison. But actually, the oil is an allergen, but it is the only known allergen that the majority of the population reacts to. But that also means some people aren't affected. Are you one of them?
No, I get poison ivy, and I have to protect myself when I'm removing it.
Okay. And one of the things you're going to be talking about in the conference is the connection between especially poison ivy, and I guess the other poisonous vines too, and birds, which is something every time I explain it at like a talk or a Q&A, people are fascinated by. Because you know the question, how do I get rid of poison ivy forever? And the answer is, I guess, is move to Greenland or something. Talk a little bit about the connection between birds and poison ivy, because people find this fascinating that the birds don't get poison ivy internally.
Birds and people are a lot alike. Birds like shiny things just like people. People like shiny Mercedes-Benz. Birds like shiny seeds. They both eat them. Nobody eats a Mercedes, but the birds eat those seeds. And then they'll come in the winter after they eat the seeds, and they want to see what you're doing in your house. They'll sit on your deck. They'll look in your window. They want to see what your air conditioner is and spinning. And all those places that are shiny and spinning in your house are where birds are going to come. They'll defecate the seeds out. The poison ivy starts right there.
Which explains why so much poison ivy is found growing next to or up the sides of trees, because the birds were clearly roosting in a branch of that tree when they let go.
That's right.
Most people have never seen the berries, though. Are they what are called insignificant in the horticultural world, or do the birds just love them so much they gobble them up in the fall as soon as they appear?
Oh, from about October through the end of February, the birds, first the migrating birds and then the overwintering birds, are focused on those seeds. They're very important to them. Not only they're a food source to them, they're a pharmaceutical to them. And they will focus on them until the meteorological spring starts. When that starts, they could care less about poison ivy. Even if they're on the plant, they won't touch them anymore.
Poison ivy is bird medicine.
That's correct.
How?
It is a anesthetizing agent for them. They're tremendous athletes. They have to move. During the night, they fly. During the day, they sit down and roost. They have to eat a lot. They have to be able to pass all those things out and quickly move on to the next. The poison ivy berries are physiologically and also packaged by their shape in that way to do that job for the birds.
So it's probably not only possible, but very common that a poison ivy plant that grows in my backyard could have come from a state further north if a bird was on a real tear.
That's right. The subspecies that we are dealing with here in Philadelphia is starting up in northern New Hampshire and going all the way down to Guatemala. It's the same subspecies.
And I could see how you could make a trail. You eat some berries, you fly for, these birds can fly 100 miles in a day, right?
And at night, they fly at night.
And so then you lighten your load, as you say, you get some more to eat, you fly to the next state. You're like Johnny freaking Appleseed, but, you know, a bad deal for everybody.
That's right, except the birds and the poison ivy.
Let's talk about removal. What I always recommend is, first of all, if you are overly sensitive, that you should go get ivy block, the clay that you put on your skin to protect yourself. And then what I suggest is once you have identified the plant, you soak the soil with water. And then rather than use gloves or anything that's going to get the oil on your skin and transfer it, use heavy shopping bags from the mall. Pull the plant. Once you get the root out of the soaking wet soil, wrap the bags around the plant, throw that into another bag or a trash can, then start with fresh bags. Because my concern is anything you use is going to pick up the oil, then you're going to get oil off those gloves, off those pruners, you know, forever.
Exactly right, Mike. That's beautiful and exactly the correct advice.
But you don't go around with plastic bags because you actually have a poison ivy removal service. Am I correct?
That's right. But it's the same idea. I protect myself with protective clothing and I have what works for me. But we also get into the larger plants, which need more care. Now, on the fourth day of the conference, I have a plant scoped out down near Boathouse Row, and I have permission from Fairmont Park to remove it. This is a female poison ivy. She's about 30 years old, and she's about 58 feet tall. And when we weigh it out, she's going to come in between 350 and 400 pounds.
And Boathouse Row, by the way, is an area, beautiful area of Philadelphia on the Schuylkill River, just below the Art Museum. Is this poison ivy attached to a tree with those hair-like fingers?
Yes, it's attached to a hackberry tree. And this particular plant is not exhibiting those very hair-like all over the whole stem. This one is a little bit more of a naked stem.
Oh, so it's probably trapped a million people, right? Who didn't recognize it.
Could be. Yeah, could be.
You know, you remind me one thing that I'd like to warn people when they're walking through the woods is don't be incautious about pushing what you think is a tree branch out of your way. Because if there's a poison ivy vine going up the other side of the tree, very well the branches of the poison ivy could be hanging down in front of your face as you're walking through the woods.
That's right. That's very correct. They can very much look like a branch of a tree in a mature plant.
Now, you have a website, which is a great name. I often wonder how people snag these when the domain names were up for grabs. Your website is idontwantpoisonivy.com. You know, that's kind of right down to the point. And you do poison ivy removal. In the minute or two we have left, what do you want to tell a homeowner who sees poison ivy in their backyard or thinks they have poison ivy? Because there's so much bad information out there. Give your advice. You've heard mine.
If you can recognize the plant, then you can stay away from it and make your best decision of whether you feel safe using Mike's recommendations to pull it out, or whether you think that it's beyond you and you need some help in pulling it out. That help can come from a lot of different places. The main thing is the identification and to go about getting this invader out of your yard without fear. So take the time that you need to look at the advice, to feel in yourself that advice is right, and then make steps cautiously because we don't want you ending up in the emergency room.
It is the only medical emergency in dermatology when people are overcome by poison ivy. And one thing we've forgotten to say that I think is so important, because people will go to a store and they'll see an herbicide that says poison ivy killer. That part is true. You can spray this noxious chemical on the plant and the plant will die. But the oil is still there, and the oil's allergenic. And how many people have gotten poison ivy from pulling out a dead plant that they thought had been rendered harmless?
That's very true. And really, herbicide is not a good solution for a poison ivy problem. To understand what the problem is, to look at it, and to make an informed decision is a much better choice.
You know, I often recommend a flame weeder for driveway weeds and circumstances. And I know, reading the medical literature, that people have literally died inhaling poison ivy smoke. Is there any way to stress how important it is not to burn this plant? Now, for instance, doesn't it get burned accidentally a lot when it's adhered to a piece of firewood?
That's true. If it gets burnt, the problem is that the combustibility, the combustion temperature that it takes to burn the wood is below the combustion that it takes to dissolve the resin. And so the resin that is still allergenic is carried on the particles of smoke or particles of soot. That's what's breathed in and causes a real problem.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, and that's one. I mean, there's a lot of reasons firefighters who fight forest fires have respirators, but that's a big one. Poison ivy on the inside of your lungs. Again, I've read the medical literature. It's horrendous. I mean, you're dying from the inside out.
Yeah, there's no choice but steroids at that point.
So be careful. If you're having a bonfire or you're burning weeds, always make sure that plant never gets torched. All right. Our guest has been Umar Mica. His website is idontwantpoisonivy.com, and he'll be presenting the first Poison Ivy Conference in Philadelphia's Fairmount Park, March 25th to the 28th. And we'll put up a link to more information about Umar and his conference and his website at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Umar, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden, and keep up the good fight against PI.
Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate you having me here. Thank you.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm Joe. I'm in South Philly, and I am looking to do a time-lapse of some plants that flower. I actually have a record label called Data Garden, and we release music on plantable paper. It has like an album cover on the front, and then there's a download code on the back, so you can download the music, and then you can plant this piece of paper, and it grows into flowers. But I want to demonstrate that for people, and I've tried doing it once. I mean, I've grown it in natural light, but I want to grow it in like a controlled environment, so I can do a time lapse with green screen and make it fun. What can we do?
Does the plant have anything to do with the music?
The plant has more to do with it having a really small seed that can fit on paper that can be printed on two sides. We do have an album called Time Lapse in Color, which would go really well with watching a time lapse of a flower grow.
Right. So you know, for instance, the things that look the best in time lapse photography tend to be big seeds, like a corn stalk coming up out of the ground, or the leaves of a pole bean plant unfolding, and obviously they're not the kind of things that can be pressed into paper.
Yeah.
Most flower seeds, however, are pretty small. The ones that I would suggest, the first thing that comes to mind would be marigolds.
Okay, cool.
You know, long, thin seeds. And are you going to progress to the finished flower?
Yeah. Well, we already have paper made with lobelia seeds. That's what I'm looking to really grow and get a nice time lapse of. And it grows fine in natural light. But when I did a time lapse in artificial light of the lobelia seed, it grew really tall, but it didn't flower.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if I'm using the wrong kind of light, or if I need to like turn off the light to simulate night and things like that.
It takes a long time to grow lobelia from seed, whereby marigolds come up really fast. And there's a variety of marigold called Firecracker that is just has an amazing variety of colors in a single flower head. Gathering seed from marigolds is super easy. Although outside, you know, lobelias in a warm climate will self-seed themselves. They'll come back year after year from dropped seed. What kind of artificial light are you using?
I was using incandescent full spectrum.
Incandescent?
Yeah.
Like a hot light?
Not like a hot light.
Well, that's what incandescent means. Do you mean
so like a light bulb, like a full spectrum light bulb?
Okay, but it one that generates heat.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Yeah, that's, I've not really ever heard of those being used for starting plants. And as soon as you start to say something like full spectrum, I can see right away it's not bright enough.
Okay.
So the cheapest thing you could do is go out and buy a shop light, a 2-tube, 4-foot-long shop light. You would want to use the new energy-efficient T8 bulbs. They're 32-watt, but they give off a lot of light, and you want to keep the plants very close to the top of the light. One of the advantages of fluorescent light is it's cool, so the tops of the plants can be very close to the lights, and that's when you get your strongest plant growth. There's also, if you wanted to invest a little bit of money, there are some new-to-the-market little mini indoor gardens. I'm testing one right now. It's amazing. It's all black lucite, very sexy. And it's got this light bar at the top that has 7 LEDs built into it. And the LEDs, the color is perfect. The color rendition is really white. It's not like those early blue ones. And the unit itself is very sleek and sexy. But those would be your two choices. You know, you can go to a home store and get a two-tube, four-foot-long shop light with the bulbs for like $30. And then just, you know, use the chains that come with it to raise and lower it to keep it close to the plants. You could actually, if you wanted to have the thing on chains and you didn't want the lights in the picture, you could just lift up the lights every time you took a picture and then drop them back down again to give the plant good light. But marigolds would come up really fast, and the progression of seed to colorful flower would be much faster than with lobelia. But if you're going to use a shop light that's got, you know, 2 4-foot long tubes, you can have a bunch of things growing in there and be shooting multiple types of flowers at the same time and then really decide what you like at the end.
Great.
All right, good luck, Joe.
Cool. Thank you, Mike.
Take care, man.
Yeah.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn listeners that my springtime tour continues. I'll appear at the Suburban Home and Garden Show at the Expo Center in Oaks, PA, Friday through Sunday, February 22nd through the 24th. At the Wilmington Home Show at the Chase Center on the waterfront, Saturday and Sunday, March 2nd and 3rd. And I'll deliver my annual lecture at the famed Philadelphia Flower Show at 1 o'clock on Wednesday, March 6th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and a visit from the three sisters. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the three sisters, that famous Native American technique of growing corn, beans, and squash all together, all complementing each other, all helping each other grow. It's a fascinating topic. We'll tell you all about it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Marilyn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Marilyn. How are you?
I'm super. Sunshine in Missouri today and a great day.
Oh, rubbing it in. What part of Missouri?
St. Joseph. It's about 50 miles from Kansas City.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Marilyn in Missouri?
Well, I have been plagued with box elder bugs. Outside, they're all over my house. and some of them are coming inside.
Yes.
What do you suggest you spray them with?
I don't suggest you spray the house with anything. That would get expensive really fast. And, of course, whatever it is would seep in and probably do more harm to you than the bugs. Does this happen in the fall, or this is happening to you now in the late winter?
Now, they start coming in the fall, but now they're really thick, looking for a warm spot, I guess. When the sun comes out, here they come.
Right, and they congregate on the south-facing side of your house.
Right.
Okay. The bad news is you would have to cut down all the box elder trees within like 5 miles to get them to completely stop. But the good news is there are very simple traps you can use to capture them before they get into your house. If you go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org and click on where it says Garden Answers A to Z, we have, and you can find it under box elder bugs or stink bugs or lady beetles. All of these are classified as home invading insects. But there is a guy who made this simple trap. And really what it is you take the two big parts of a pizza box, and then you make some cardboard lanes in between so that the box is, has openings in it. And they can go in, and it's like a little maze inside. And you simply hang this on the outside of the wall. They're looking for a place to get in. So they crawl into these holes in these boxes like mad. Anything you would hang on the outside of your south-facing wall like this that had a way for them to get in, they'll go in, and then they'll stay there. And then when the box is filled, you can just tape it up and throw it away, or you can empty them into a big bucket of soapy water and reuse the box. But it's very easy to capture them before they can get into the house. And there's instructions at our website on how to build these. And there's YouTube videos of the guy himself showing you how to do it with different pieces of cardboard. But it's a really easy answer to a problem that just drives people crazy.
How do I recognize a box elder tree?
Well,
it's in the dictionary says it's in the maple and the ash family, but I go outside and I don't see any of them on the tree.
No. They only feed on the tree for a short period of time.
Oh, okay.
But that's where they got their name. But in the wintertime, they are natural hibernators. They seek out caves or places like that where they can crawl in a crevice and hide until the warm weather comes around again. And, of course, they think our homes are those caves.
Right. So, okay, well, I'll look up on the website and see and follow that and see what good luck I have.
Okay.
Sounds great. I'll give it a try.
All right. Good luck, Marilyn.
Thank you so much for your time. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Brad, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thanks, Mike. How are you doing?
I am doing just fine, Brad. How are you, sir?
Oh, doing great. Man, I love your show. I listen to it every Saturday morning from 6 a.m. to 7 in Nashville on 90.3 WTLN.
All right. Good for you and good for them, Brad. Is that where you live in Nashville?
Yeah, that's where I live right now, and that's what reason I'm calling. I live in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, which is in the Nashville market, and my wife received a promotion, and we're going to be moving to Memphis. And I have a plum tree that I planted, not this past November, but a year before that. So I planted it November a year ago to produce fruit last spring. I took that fruit and threw it away as soon as I saw them to give the tree a chance to establish itself.
Oh, good for you.
And then I was going to do that again this year. And my question is, I want to take it with me. You know, we're selling our home. I want to take my plum tree with me. And I know that I should, I need to probably dig it up before it starts to come out. We're going to move to Memphis around March 18th. And, with the kind of the climate these days, it starts to get warm down here earlier. So I wanted to ask you, when should I dig her up to transplant her to Memphis? And how would I take care of her if I need to pull her out of the ground before it's time to leave?
Well, first of all, if you have sold your home, that plant got sold with it, unless you made other provisions.
it's on the market. We haven't sold it yet, and they know I'm going to take it with me.
Oh, okay. All right, because that needs to be put in there. Landscaping belongs to the new owner.
Right.
Well, what I would do is on the next decent day, I would get out there. Do you need a big container? You ever see these big blue recycling tubs that they put out for people to put their mixed bottles, cans, and other recyclables in?
Sure.
They make excellent plant transport containers. I actually used a couple of those type of tubs when I first got my peach trees. It was supposed to be a cicada emergence year, and I was worried the cicadas would eat my young trees, so I actually grew them in those tubs the first year so that I could cover them with netting and protect them. Of course, the cicadas never showed up, but it worked really well. So what I would suggest is you score one of those. You can find something similar, maybe get like a Rubbermaid container and punch a bunch of holes in the bottom. But I really like that hard plastic. The roots of the peach trees that I was holding over did really well in it. You know, how tall is this thing?
At this point, she's about 4 feet right now.
Okay, yeah, this should be pretty easy. You want to take a shovel and you want to start like a good foot and a half away from the trunk and start digging in a circle around it. And then when you make a full circle, start testing until finally you can lift up everything, you know, an entire island of soil. You really shouldn't even see any roots. And then you want to have some good soil already in the container. And then you want to have a little bit of help and very carefully lift this peach tree up out of the earth and drop it down into the container and then add soil so that the tree is, you know, at the same height it was in the ground. And then you can, you know, water it if it gets dry, put it in a good spot. With that much soil around its roots, and if you don't disturb it, it won't know anything is happening. And then if the weather is really fierce, if all of a sudden spring has devolved into a hot summer, just grow the tree in that container and then plant it in the ground like September or October of the coming fall.
Okay. I mean, if we get to Memphis and if spring hasn't sprung yet, can I put it in the ground when I get to Memphis, or should I keep it in that container until the fall?
If you don't need to put it in the ground, think of all the other stuff you're going to have to do moving into a new house. I would urge you to leave it in the container because it's going to suffer a lot less transplant shock in the fall than it will in the spring, because you know how quick your summer can heat up.
Right.
And if it's not totally acclimated, it's really going to suffer, whereby in the fall it's already going dormant. You move it again, it really won't know it. It's like bringing a little kid into the house late at night. You can bang them into a couple things. They don't wake up.
Okay. And then once I pull it out, should I leave it outside or bring it like inside my garage?
No, you should put it in this big container and leave it out in a normal area. Your winters aren't devastatingly freezing. I think it'll do fine.
Okay, perfect.
And don't forget to fill in the hole and plant something nice.
Oh, that's what I'll do. I'll leave them. I might just grab another tree and take mine with me and leave them one there.
There you go.
I love your show, and you're going to help us this fall. We're going to go from in the ground gardening. We're going to do raised beds this year. We think it's going to help us a lot. I learned a lot about raised beds by listening to you, Mike, so we really appreciate everything.
All right. Well, you'll never go back. You're going to love it.
All right. You have a great day. Thank you.
You too, sir.
Right, bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. The three sisters, corn, squash, and beans. Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer, please read this week's intriguing question.
Well, Mike, we heard from John in Edmond, Oklahoma, who writes, I have set aside an area in my vegetable garden to try the three sisters technique of growing corn, beans, and squash. Do you have any suggestions as to what type of squash and beans to plant? I've been told that I can use just about any type of pole bean, green beans or others, and just about any bush or non-vining cucumbers, squash, or pumpkins to cover the ground? And are there any recommended varieties for the corn?
Well, I learned quite a bit about the Three Sisters when we staged a major exhibit featuring Native American culture at the Philadelphia Flower Show back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine in the 1990s. The three crops are part of an intricate Iroquois legend about the world's beginning, springing up out of the earth to feed and nurture the first human beings. But our friend John in Oklahoma is a little misinformed about the specific nature of the crops in question. Although some corn and beans were almost certainly eaten fresh, the majority of the harvests of America's first farmers were for winter storage. Thus, the corn was grown to be dried for grinding into cornmeal. Same for the beans. They were selected for their ability to be dried and stored. And Native Americans didn't know from cucumbers. The squash would have been winter squash, varieties that store well and even improve in flavor over the winter. Think about it. There was plenty of fresh edible vegetation growing all around in the summer. But squirreling away lots of corn, beans, and squash was essential for staying alive and healthy over the winter. And the actual growing technique is a master class in space utilization. You'd plant varieties of flower corn whose stalks were especially sturdy so they could handle the bean vines that would be tugging at them. Near those stalks, you'd plant pole-climbing beans that produced big, nutritious seeds, but whose vines weren't so heavy and aggressive that they'd start tugging the corn down to the ground. Then, when those crops were up and growing, you'd plant pumpkins and other winter squash with really broad leaves around them to shade the soil, conserve moisture, and keep weed growth down. Just the opposite of what you'd get from the more modern bush-style squash varieties. Now, to make the circle even more complete, the bean vines would be plowed back into the soil or buried in another area at the end of the season so that their nitrogen-rich vines would decompose and provide some food for the next season's corn crop. Pretty smart. And I would not advise trying this with regular sweet corn or string beans, as the ideal Three Sisters are not picked at all during the season. It's hard to imagine how you could get in there to pick without stepping all over the poor squash vines. And the stalks of modern sweet corn just aren't strong enough to support vigorous pole bean vines. But there's a lot of benefit to growing the storage versions of these crops. Unlike sweet corn and string beans, which must be picked within a certain window of freshness, drying corn and beans are left to fully mature and then dry on the plant before harvest, by which time the squash, which got planted last, should be fully ripe. We had a bunch of good advisors who guided our hand in selecting varieties for our flower show exhibit. For white flower corns, they recommended Tuscadora, Iroquois White, and Cherokee White. For the darker colored corns, they recommended the dramatically blue-black kerneled Black Iroquois and Black Aztec, and finally the multicolored Rainbow Inca, which a lot of people out there will know simply as ornamental corn. Recommended beans included the beautiful speckled purple Scarlet Runner, whose tubular red flowers also attract lots of hummingbirds in the summer. Genuine Cornfield, which will produce well even in Oklahoma-level heat. Hopi Purple, and the one that looked the nicest on dried bean display, True Cranberry, which is an absolutely authentic Native American variety. For squash, several sources recommended Long Pie, which is also known as Indian Pumpkin and Golden Oblong. It's an especially long-keeping variety that was still being grown by Native American tribes in 1996. They also recommended the Kushaw type of bottle-shaped storage squashes. Planting styles vary greatly, but our experts agreed on a couple of things. In areas of normal rainfall, you'd plant your systems in raised beds or built-up plots. But in dry areas like Oklahoma and Arizona, you'd plant in depressions with the outer walls high enough to shield the young plants from dry winds. multiple groups of three corn plants each is a common design, with two pole bean plants per group. No more than that, or the vines would overwhelm the corn. Go light on the squash as well. As people who have grown pumpkins and other squash know all too well, the vines grow aggressively, and the leaves of just a few plants will cover a very large area. I'll add that this is a clear case for running drip irrigation lines over the area before planting. They'll make the most efficient use of your water. And overhead watering would be begging for disease problems on all those squash leaves. Harvest is going to be easy. Let the corn and beans stand till they're bone dry and harvest the squash just before the first frost. And don't forget to bury those bean vines where you're going to grow the three sisters the following year. Well, that sure was some useful information about the three sisters, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it over carefully, with lots more variety names and other information we just couldn't fit in today's show. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to stomp on my squash if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live so we don't have to email you back and ask you. Please put the actual subject of your email in the subject line so we get your email. And perhaps check voiced to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems just like yours in our Garden Answers A to Z section, listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook, where we post new content every day or close to it. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been WHYY's senior engineer, Mr. Fred Snyder. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Our social media director, Amanda McGrath, has no sisters, but her brother does resemble a pole bean. Ace production assistant, Brett Rader. Well, he also kind of resembles a pole bean. Esteemed editor, Al Banks, looks a little squashed today. Sisterly Alexis Landis proudly produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm Corny Mike McGrath, and I'll see you again next week. Love to garden, but hate having to battle weeds? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll end your weeding woes with a little trick we call the stale seedbed. Plus your fabulous phone calls.